Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. A new study from the Center for Racial Equity in Education, or CREED, confirms once again that students of color have diminished access to resources that affect their success, including advanced coursework, experienced teachers, and the racial ethnic matching of students and educators. Those factors not only impact how a student feels about their K-12 education, it can rob children of their full potential. North Carolina State Board of Education member and former State Teacher of the Year James Ford is the executive director of CREED and co-author of the study, which is entitled Erasing Inequities, the State of Racial Equity in North Carolina Public Schools. He sat down with News and Views producer Clayton Henkel to discuss the report.
James Ford serves on the State Board of Education. He was North Carolina's Teacher of the Year in 2015. He's an education consultant on issues of equity. His latest venture is called CREED, the Center for Racial Equity in Education. James Ford, thanks for being on News and Views.
I'm so happy to be here again.
Well, James, as we mentioned, you wear many hats, and let's talk a little bit about your role on the State Board of Education. We're starting a new school year. What are some of the top issues that you have as teachers are heading back and they're getting ready for a whole brand new crop of students?
Well, I mean, we have a host of different issues, but I think one of the things that I've been trying to focus on as the chair for the Strategic Planning Committee for the State Board for the next 5 years, 2020 to 2025, is us helping to close opportunity gaps for the most historically marginalized groups, you know, helping to make sure that teachers have the assistance that they need, the supports that they need to be able to accommodate the students. There's so many different factors that undergird education, and yet we kind of get saddled with all the baggage and all the blame. But really, it's about building systems and taking systemic approaches to helping to deal with these things, mental health services, helping to mitigate chronic absenteeism, helping to close what are called achievement gaps, but really are things that deal with lack of opportunity, be it because of economics or be it because of race. Responding to some of the most pervasive systemic aspects of what really robs kids of their potential are some of the things we've been focusing on, not just with the strategic plan, but writ large.
Well, we're going to talk about a lot of those things as we talk about a new report that you've come out with, and we ought to say that the State Board of Education recently just approved your strategic plan for 2025. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's our plan.
I'm appreciative to
have a part in that.
Well, one concern that I do want to touch on, because I'd be remiss if I did not, is school safety. That's a top concern for so many parents as they're getting ready to send their sons and their daughters back to school. We know that the state superintendent introduced a new app earlier this year for students to report incidents that they thought were concerning, but it's not enough in this climate. We've got to be doing more to keep our public schools safe.
Goodness, not just our public schools, but our public places in general, right? And what a salient and timely topic. And you're absolutely right. Listen, I represent Region 6. Charlotte Mecklenburg is one of those school districts. Of course, we know that a student lost their life in one of our schools last year due to gun violence. And it continues to be one of those situations that there's not really a hard or fast solution to, because on the one hand, you can place metal detectors, you can put all sorts of barriers up to entry, et cetera. But there seems to be a larger culture of violence that we're struggling to deal with. But our job is to keep kids safe. And I'm not necessarily certain that the presence of increased SROs is the answer either, although many of them do good work. We've seen that sometimes they have exacerbated already difficult and tenuous situations. And so if students don't feel safe, they can't learn, right? And so school safety is paramount to what our job is as a state board. But it continues to be something we struggle figuring out just how to rectify. And so I will acknowledge that full thoroughly. But we're still, you know, of course, paying much attention to that. That app, I think, will provide some assistance, but I don't think there's a foolproof plan whatsoever.
Another challenge this year is going to be the politically charged climate that we're in as we march up to the 2020 election. Certainly, sometimes the rhetoric that we hear in the household is carried over into the schoolyard, and it's going to be something that teachers, I imagine, have to deal with. And I'm not just talking about teachers who are in a poli-sci class trying to teach politics.
Listen, you know, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, just kind of taking off my state board hat and just put my purely educator hat on here, we have to begin to rediscover what's the true virtue of education here, right? Particularly in a democracy where, you know, we're supposed to be self-governing folk and we're supposed to share power. with one another. And when you are in an environment that is inherently oppressive to groups across lines of difference, whether talking about race, religion, nationality, regardless of immigration status, etc., that has direct implications to what happens at the school. And far be it from educators, be they teachers, be they school leaders, to kind of distance ourselves from this, we have to hit this head on and recognize that, you know, some things are inherently political. They don't have to be partisan, right? But to some things, I think, transcend even partisanship. Kids should feel safe. They should feel welcome. They should feel affirmed for who they are. And it's our job as educators to teach them and to teach them well. We can't just turn a negligent eye to what's happening or to close our ears. We have to find ways to respond to these things through our pedagogy. And that's kind of what our charge is and what my personal mission is.
Yeah, you had a great analogy. I think you were speaking in New Hanover County, and you were looking at different puzzle pieces, and you spoke very eloquently to sometimes not everything fits, not everything. You don't even know what the picture's going to be, but you've got to kind of keep working at that landscape.
Mm-hmm. Because all the pieces fit, and we have to operate on that assumption, but we got to figure it out.
Let's shift gears a little bit, and we're going to talk about your latest venture. This is with the Center for Racial Equity in Education. It's also known as CREED. You're out with a really important, weighty report. It's called Erasing Inequities, and we should tell our listeners that it's E-R-A-C-I-N-G, Erasing Inequities, the State of Racial Equity in North Carolina's Public Schools. Let's just start out by defining, what is racial equity?
Yeah, so for us, and I'll use a little more direct and higher level English, and then I'll just kind of break it down for you. But the way we define the report is that racial equity is achieved when education outcomes are not predicted by race and ethnicity of the students, where the conditions of education are not predicted by the race, ethnicity, or the composition of that place, where the root causes are purposely and continually examined and reexamined, where you have diverse perspectives embedded within and valued across the power structures. What that means is that ultimately, when we can look at these data and we can say that race is no longer relevant, how these outcomes or even access indicators are expressed, then we know that we've reached a state of racial equity. But we talk about race because it's relevant, because we're at a point now, and I think the report proves that, that the data express it in a very nuanced way. If there were no correlation, there would be no pattern. And so we're trying to de-link those two things as best we can and try to create an environment where a student's true ability matches their access and their outcomes. And that's not something that's determined by the racial and ethnic group.
So that question that you ask in the very first pages of it, does race influence educational access and outcomes? Yeah. The answer is yes.
Yeah, pretty unequivocally, right? And the other thing we should mention is that there's another report that has come out along with this called Deep Rooted, which provides a historical analysis of race and education, those two concepts, looking specifically at North Carolina. And the reason why that's important is because, yes, it does have influence, but that's because it always has, right? There's a historical trend here. But I think what's interesting is that this report is dense. You've looked at it. It's a whole lot. You can't drink it in all at once. But the nuanced ways that it manifests itself in ways that, you know, perhaps aren't as obvious, that are baked in just systemically, where race still has a tremendous influence over the variance of opportunity and access. And it's something that the more you know about, hopefully we can begin to respond to. But unequivocally, in North Carolina and elsewhere, it remains something that has an influence.
Well, let's look at some of the factors that you mentioned in this report. The first one out of the gate is teachers and access to the most experienced teachers.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people think that their schools are pretty good. They probably have good teachers there, but that's not the case. Sometimes those good teachers don't stay in the schools where they're needed most.
That's right. And generally, those people would be right, right? I mean, there probably are good teachers just about everywhere, but there's a distribution, right? And in our report, we reveal that the students of color are more exposed to novice teachers. And not that that's an indicator necessarily of quality, but let's be clear, the longer that you're in the profession, you're going to gain institutional knowledge, you're going to get repetitions, and that matters, right? And those teachers remain harder to retain, right? Oftentimes you get the most inexperienced teachers after they get a few years under their belt and maybe a majority of color school, and they transfer out. And so that has a bearing in how talent is distributed and the opportunity that students have. And so that's an area of grave concern for us.
This was something that I've seen before. I've seen the stat before, but I don't think a lot of our listeners are aware of it, that 80% of North Carolina's teachers are white.
Yes.
Tell us, why does that matter if you are a student of color?
Yes, that's an excellent question. And, you know, on its face, it doesn't, right? I mean, everybody should be able to teach, right? No matter who you are, we enter this profession for the right reasons, hopefully. But what the research has told us, research that we haven't conducted but have based our analysis on, is that it matters in a multitude of ways. It has a bearing not only on the academic achievement of students, but their propensity or probability of being either referred for academically and intellectually gifted courses. It also has a bearing on how often or how frequently they get suspended. And so all these other non-academic factors, which are actually we term as access indicators, it has a bearing on those things as well. So in our report, you see that for white students, 90% of the courses that they take are taught by a teacher of their same race. That's a systemic advantage, right? If race matching has a positive influence. But for black students, it's more like a third, like 33%. Even more, though, I mean, I should stop here, for Latinx students and for Asian students, right? So for Latinx students, the proportion of students in our education system versus the proportion of Latinx teachers is like seven times. There's a difference of seven times, right? And for Asian students, it's three times. And there aren't a whole lot of Asian students to begin with. They're about 4% of overall enrollment. So for that to be three times the proportion of Asian teachers, that's concerning, right? So how do we make sure that these advantages are properly distributed to historically marginalized racial groups as well?
Another way of stating that would be, if I never see a teacher that looks like me, I might not feel like I could go on to college or have a career even in that field. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I mean, in plain speak, if you can't see it, you can't be it, right? Well, it's harder anyway. We need folks to be role model, but also there's a cultural capital that comes, right, that we have to acknowledge just from having lived and been, you know, in this body, right? When I step in a classroom, students who see me feel affirmed oftentimes, and I have an orientation with how I teach and how I go about this work and show up. So all that matters.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the other factors in this report. Advanced placement courses, AP mm-hmm. courses. Students of color are underrepresented typically in these classes.
Yeah, and there's a lot of reasons for that, right? When we look at, again, the school composition, what we find is that, again, the greater the density of students of color in the school, the fewer AP courses that are offered. And so almost systemically, there are students, about 6% of students of color, about 13,000 students, who, even if they wanted to take AP courses, their schools don't offer enough AP courses to get what is called North Carolina Academic Scholars Endorsement, which makes you a more viable candidate for scholarships, makes you a more attractive candidate for higher ed institutions. So even if these kids did want to take AP courses, their schools offer so few of these AP courses, they don't qualify for this very illustrious endorsement, which is like a quality factor in as they pursue higher education. And so nobody's going to see that on his face. People may say, nobody's holding you back, but there's things that are baked in we're just not paying attention to.
Yeah, absolutely. If you are a whiz at STEM classes, science, technology, engineering, math, if you are unable to take those classes because of the school you're in, chances are you're not really going to gain anyone's attention who's looking at your college transcript.
Right. And here's the thing, you know, even if you're not, and we break down, you know, who's getting threes, fours, and fives, right, et cetera, but the quality points, right? So even if you get a C, right, in an AP class, even without taking the test per se, the quality points and what that does for your GPA, right? That's like taking an A in a regular, it's getting an A in a regular class. And then it's just this whole thing of stretching students, right? When you expose them to greater rigor, they tend to rise to the occasion, right, more than the opposite. And so are we doing justice by our students of color when these are the numbers and this is the reality?
You mentioned this earlier, chronic absenteeism. I know that that is something that the State Board of Education or the State Board didn't really even measure until very recently, and you're measuring it now. But talk a little bit about how one suspension can impact the likelihood that a student will then become chronically absent.
What's interesting in our analysis is that we found that being suspended once increased your likelihood of being chronically absent by 350%.
Whoa. Say that again.
Being suspended once increased the likelihood of being chronically absent by 350%.
And right. If you are chronically absent, you are missing at least 15 days, am I correct?
Oh, about 10% of days, right. So, you know, these are folks who are missing a lot of class, right? Not necessarily in succession, but overall. And, you know, the concern with that, of course, is if you're not around, you can't learn. But when you see that there's a correlation, right, and we're not claiming causation on any of this stuff, but we're saying this is worth looking at, that's problematic. The other concern is, and this is why disaggregating by race is important, generally, students of color tend to be more chronically absent, but then we use predictive models, right? Statistical predictive models in our analysis as well. And so when you account for things like socioeconomics, when you account for language, when you account for gender, when you account for ability, what we find is that actually white students are more likely to be chronically absent than students of color, which it disrupts some narratives, but also raises the question, what's going on with some of our white students? And we have to key in on solutions that specifically target that demographic. And so you wouldn't see that or you would make invisible those things if you didn't look at race. That's why this is powerfully important.
You mentioned disrupting the narrative. Let's talk a little bit about suspension and school discipline.
Yeah.
How does that factor into racial equity in our education?
I think that's a huge lever. And folks, listen, even in presidential debates now, you're starting to hear phrases like the school-to-prison pipeline be used because people readily understand that exclusionary discipline, one, is wildly ineffective, and it's applied differently based upon the racial and ethnic groups of folks. Specifically, we look at in our report what the research has talked about, and that's that there are two categories of offenses. Subjective offenses, which are more discretionary, kind of, you know, squishy, hard to define terms. They're left up to the discretion of whoever's handling the discipline. And then there are hard objective offenses, right? For Black students, for Native students, for multiracial students, that's where the greatest disparities lie. They're getting suspended for what are subjective offenses, things like disrespect, insubordination, threatening behavior. And, you know, the way I walk and talk could be interpreted as threatening or non-threatening based upon the cultural lens of whoever's allocating discipline. Those are the sort of things, again, if we don't talk about that stuff, or we try to take a color neutral approach to this, we're going to keep on over suspending kids of color.
What are some of the solutions? I imagine that in some cases, the strategic plan of 2025 that you were a part of comes into play.
Sure.
But what are some other things that we can do?
Right. So one of the things that we tried to be transparent about in this report is not trying to list a bunch of recommendations and saying, hey, these are the solutions. And frankly, one of the solutions is to begin studying these things more deeply. And we shamelessly sort of at the end say, you know, hey, the formation of CREED is our systemic response. CREED is a, if you will, a think tank, for lack of better term. It's really insufficient. But our response is to create a standalone organization that deals with closing racialized opportunity gaps for students in the P20 pipeline throughout North Carolina, so that race is no longer a predictor of that. One of our three kind of branches of work is doing research, such as these two reports. But the other pieces are the engagement strategies, engaging stakeholders, parents, educators, the general public, civic leaders around an agenda for creating racial equity in education, because you have to use these findings to operationalize change. And then lastly is implementation, right? So you take these findings and you find a school or a district who says, you know what, I looked at our data and everything you're saying is clear. What do we do to help create change? And very few folk in the think tank space are offering direct service or assistance, right? So how do you help folks to make the shifts and the changes pedagogically or from a policy standpoint that really help increase opportunity for students of color? And so those are the three things that we're focused on.
There are a lot of folks who, whether you're in the corporate world or whether you work in the nonprofit sector or whether you work in public education, you've probably in the last year or two been to a race equity workshop. Mm-hmm. And invariably, there's some people that feel very uncomfortable in that setting. They feel like you're pointing a finger at them, that you're saying that they're a racist somehow. But that's not what we're saying here. This has nothing to do with that. You're trying to get people to go a little bit deeper and be comfortable in some cases with being uncomfortable.
Very well stated. And, you know, my general mode of operation whenever broaching conversations on race is to be infinitely harder on systems and softer on people. Now, you can make the argument that systems are built of people, right? And that's accurate and fair. But ultimately, what we're talking about is dismantling the machinery. Because if we just focus on individuals, we're going to be applying individualized solutions to what really are institutional problems. And frankly, you know, when you have conversations about this, you're going to get uncomfortable. It's if I may, a bit of entitlement to expect to enter these conversations and to walk away feeling the warm fuzzies, right? You should be disturbed. You should be upset, right? You should feel convicted because these are kids, right? These are real lives we're talking about here, you know? We're talking about suspensions, right? We're talking about, in the case of Black kids, 30,000 Black kids who are being over suspended. If they were at the state average, it'd be 30,000 fewer kids. Black kids who would be getting suspended versus how many are getting suspended now. Those are real lies, right? And that should shake us up. But I don't want us to shy away from that. I don't think that the national or political climate permits us to do that. We've done that. We can kick the ball and punt it for too long. And, you know, in the preaching world, you know, they say you got to face it to fix it. And I think that we're at that point now. We're just going to have to face this down and come about it with open hearts. And we're going to have to endure. It's going to hurt some. But that's not the destination. That's just the path that leads to prosperity.
You got to face it to fix it, and you also have to read this report. The name of the report, again, is Erasing Inequities, the State of Racial Equity in North Carolina's Public Schools. It's by Nicholas Triplett and James Ford. Tell us, James, where can folks find this online?
You can find it at either EducationNC, which is ednc.org, or also on Creed's website, which is creed-nc.org.
All right. Fantastic. James Ford, thank you so much for spending a few minutes of your time with us.
Clayton, thank you for having me so much.
Well, that's it for this edition of News and Views. Be sure to check us out online and subscribe to our free newsletters at ncpolicywatch.com. For producer Clayton Henkel, this is Rob Schofield. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to News and Views. A weekly look at state and policy issues is a production of North Carolina Policy Watch. Visit them online at ncpolicywatch.com.